I invite you now to open to the book of Esther that we got started on yesterday. And let us set again the background of the story. The king, Ahasuerus, or as we know him, I think, a little bit better historically, Xerxes I, came to power upon his father Darius' death. His father was already planning to push the Persian Empire farther west into the Greek homelands. But he never got the chance because of his death. So now that Xerxes has come to power and he's settled some matters of family debate about whether or not he had the right to the throne, he is ready to take up that same dream of invading and conquering the Greek homelands. So we are in the third year of his reign, which is 484 going into 483 BC, and he has thrown a 180-day party. Now that's half of a year. A 180-day party of trying to stoke up this support for him as the king that is now going to expand even farther westward. And he had one final 7-day blowout feast at the capital city of Susa, where he's got all the men with him and all the ladies are with his primary wife, Vashti. And they are drinking vintages from all over the empire. And no doubt talking about how grand it is that the empire is so big, and wouldn't it be great for it to be even bigger and to have even more vintage at their disposal. And so verse number 10 of Ezra chapter 1 says, on the 7th day of that final big blowout, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, because no doubt he knows he's about to finish up all of this time together with others. He's feeling that he should let go a little bit more of his inhibitions. So he is no doubt in his cups, as we say. So he commanded Mehumen, Bistha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zetar, and Karkas, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. So he orders his top servants, which are kind of a combination of like a political servant plus secret service. So he orders the top 7 guys, I want you to escort the queen from her private female-oriented gathering into this gathering of the gentlemen, because I want them to see how amazing she looks in her royal robes with her beauty. And that did not go over well with Queen Vashti. It says in verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Not surprising, really. I mean, she is probably a princess of high standing. She is an individual in her own right. She has functioned as the queen for some time, and she is not just some pretty face. She is a wise woman, politically astute, very powerful. She is the most powerful woman in the empire, and she is probably one of the most powerful persons in the entire empire. And here she is being treated like some sort of lackey or some sort of pet or piece of meat. And she is not going to put up with that. And so that triggers the king. At this, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him because he's now been embarrassed in front of all the powerful people that he's trying to impress because his wife told him no. Well, verse 13. The king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shathar, Adamtha, Tarshish, Meris, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. So the eunuchs are the servants and slash secret service. These guys are the politicians. These guys are the fellow princes, royalty. The Persian king was the king of kings. That was one of his titles. So these guys are all high-standing royalty within the empire. And they sit as his top advisors. So he tells them, you need to advise me. Verse 15, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the king, the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? So what should be done because of this blatant refusal to do what I told her to do? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, well, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, well, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she didn't come. So this guy, representing the other advisor, says, this is a major crisis. This is a major empire crisis. The women of the kingdom are going to take their cue from the queen. And if they don't feel like doing what the men in their lives want them to do, they'll just refuse. And then chaos will ensue. Now, this is even more significant given what these guys are up to with the 180-day plus seven more day banquets. They are trying to get ready to send husbands and sons and brothers off to war. And if the women are not on board with that, how are they going to conquer the Greek homelands? So they have got to nip this in the bud, is basically what Memucan says. Verse 18, this very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. So that's the crisis. Here is his recommendation as a solution. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it may not be repealed. Remember, that's an aspect of the Medo-Persian legal system. Once something has been inscribed down, on, particularly on the clay tablets, and then fired, it's permanent. It is a permanent law. And so he says, I need you to make a permanent decree and that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. So fire her. Now, this relationship, this marriage, is most certainly political. It was probably arranged long before he came to the throne. And women who were involved in these political marriages brought with them political power. And so she is basically being fired. If you want to think of it as something similar, it would be as if she had been like the ambassador from her father's country, and now she's embarrassed the king of the country where she's serving, and that king says, I want you out of my country now. Leave. Go away. Don't ever show your face in my court ever again. And so this is the political solution to a political crisis. Now, a secondary thing is said at this that doesn't happen until a couple of years later. It says, let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So hire another wife that is even more wise than she is, that can help you in your political pursuits. Verse 20. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it's vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. The idea here is a scare tactic. We know that. It's basically, hey, if the queen can be taken down because she won't toe the line, all of you women farther down the political, economic, community structure, you're not going to fare any better. You need to know your place. That's effectively what they're trying to do with this decree. And the king, who, remember, has probably had a little bit too much to drink, decides, that sounds like a good idea to me. Verse 21, this advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language. That's interesting. Something that the Persian Empire did is that they took in consideration that they were a whole bunch of different cultures under one empire. And so when decrees were made, the official decree was instantaneously translated into these multiple languages so that the people would hear the decree in their own language, which would make them feel more part of the whole. And so this is what they were being told, that every man should be master of his own household and speak according to the language of his people. So basically, the king upholds the idea of the patriarchy, the idea that the husband is the head of the household and what he says goes. That's the concept that he throws out there. Now, that is much too simplistic an explanation of what happened in the Garden of Eden that put the patriarchy in place, and that is that chaos ensued, and when you've got two persons in the household, if they disagree at some point, hopefully they disagree, they agree most of the time because they're on the same page, but if they ever do disagree, it has to be understood who has to call the shot. And so that's what actually happened in the Garden of Eden when Adam was made the head of the household. But anyway, back to the text. Ahasuerus, Xerxes, puts this decree in place and fires Vashti. And she is gone from his life. But within a matter of a couple of years, he realizes it was a big mistake, that she was very important to him. not just simply as his wife, but as the persuader of the women of the kingdom. So Esther chapter 2, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. So he starts regretting his decision. He wishes she was there to assist him and advise him. But it's impossible because the law of the Medes and the Persians say once the decree is made, it cannot be reversed. So she is gone. So what are they going to do about it? Verse 2. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young women who pleases, or the young woman who pleases the king, be queen instead of Vashti." And this pleased the king, and he did so. Now, it is interesting to me that apparently all the other wives that he must have had already, none of them measured up to Vashti. None of them he felt he could promote to that senior wife position. Because again, remember, it's not just simply about a marriage between him and her. It's also the fact that she is very wise and powerful and politically persuasive on his account with all the women and many of the men of the kingdom. He needs a partner in the kingdom that can help persuade everyone that this king is worthy of your support, and that his plan to expand the empire is worth sending your husbands and your sons and your brothers off to war. So he couldn't find anyone among his other wives that fit the bill, and he was probably pouting about it and down in the dumps and trying to figure out, how can I get Vashti back here? And that's not possible. So his closest attendees say, "Why don't you search the kingdom for a replacement? Someone that is like Vashti or even better." And so this pleased the king, and he did so. And so the candidates are all going to be young, unmarried women, because he can't, according to Persian law, go out there and grab somebody else's wife. So this is where we now have our heroine come into the story. Verse number 5. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai. He was the son of Yair, son of Shimei, son of Cush, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, it's not Mordecai that had been carried away in exile, because the exile is now closer to 110 years ago. Actually, even longer than that for Jeconiah. So it is his grandfather, great-grandfather, that had been carried away in exile. That'd be Kish and the Benjamite. So this guy now works for the kingdom of Persia. He actually works for Xerxes, just like he'd worked for his father Darius. And then, verse number 7 says, he was bringing up Hadassah. Hadassah is the name for a myrtle tree. And myrtle trees have star-shaped flowers. So the Greek name that is given to her, Hadassah is the Hebrew name for the myrtle tree. The Greek name that is given to her is Esther, which is the Greek way of talking about star-shaped flowers. And so she is the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother anymore. She's an orphan. So apparently, the family had died for reasons we don't understand. Maybe an accident, maybe some sort of disease happened. But she is now orphaned, and her older cousin is asked or puts himself forward as the adoptive parent for her to take care of her. So she is, in effect, the ward of her older cousin. Now, this is her description. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So he's raising her with this intimate connection of treating her like his own child. There's no indication that he had any children of his own. It could be that he may have become a eunuch in order to take the position in the palace here. So, when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. So from this, we can probably assume that Esther is in her teens, probably in her latter part of her teens. We don't know exactly when weddings took place amongst the Jewish community at this time, but 20 would probably be one of the latest times that marriages would have taken place. So here she is in her teens, and she is now drawn into this search for a new queen. Not just simply a wife, but for someone that can lead the women of the entire empire. Now, Haggai, who is the eunuch that's evaluating the women of Susa that are coming in, he is really taken with Esther. Verse number 9 tells us that. The young woman pleased him and won his favor. So he's now got a favorite. He starts grooming her, if you will. He starts supporting her to win this contest. So he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Harem is just the place where the women live inside the royal complex. And so Esther is on the fast track with support from Haggai to win this position. Now, verse 10, we've talked about this. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. So in this very pan-ethnic empire, there are tons and tons and tons of different ethnic groups. But everyone is kind of accepted fairly well, so that you're not asked all the time what's your background, what's your ethnicity. You are just accepted as part of the Persian Empire, with one exception. Apparently, if word gets out that you're Jewish, there is anti-Semitism that is present in the kingdom right now. We talked about the fact that there were legal challenges made against the Jewish people in the Jewish homeland by people that didn't like them down there. And so some of that is permeated up into the capital city. And so Mordecai, who's aware of that, tells her very explicitly, don't volunteer your ethnicity in this process. You're a Susa girl. You're from Susa. This is where you were born. You are part of the Persian Empire. So do it that way. And so that is the way that we will have to leave it for today and for this week. And when we get back in our next session, God willing, we will see how Esther advances to the position of Queen of the Empire.